Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
And it looks like we both came prepared this evening with alcohol.
We did. We're making up for lost time here, I think.
Well, you have. It's really cold here in the D.C. area in late December, so of course you brought a chilled white wine.
I did, but here's why. First of all, I'll give you the cork, okay, which is your first clue.
I already know what it's from.
And then here is your Sauvignon Blanc.
That is a creepy-looking bottle of wine. It's got a cat on its hind legs with laser beams coming out of its eyes like Godzilla blowing up Paris. And it's called, what is that, Chat Fou Blanc?
I guess it's like Chat Fou.
Cat Fou, but there's
the
an H in it.
Silent.
And yeah, on the cork, there's a mean-looking cat with a bunch of whiskers.
Yeah, so you got the lasers.
That's funny.
Maybe the force is with the cat.
No, this is not. All right. Well, I brought two things. Yes. Let's see if you can. They're a bit more subtle than yours. Yours has laser beams out of a cat's eyes.
So you chose Slow Press, a Cabernet Sauvignon that actually looks like a very fancy bottle, which I guess we'll open in our next podcast. But I would say for Slow Press, you're probably going for some sort of bombshell tie-in.
I am. I was in the store, and then I saw this one. I was like, oh, it's too good to pass up.
And then you saw a little bottle of Not Your Father's Root Beer, which we've had before. We did actually with It Floats. Remember, I made the root beer floats one year.
Oh, yeah, I remember you did.
And so the Not Your Father's Root Beer, I'm guessing, has something to do with Darth Vader, Star Wars,
The most overt reference would be The Empire Strikes Back, but there are some father somewhat figure issues in Star Wars : Episode 9: The Rise of Skywalker.
Yes.
I think there are. So it was too good to pass
up. All right, so we've got a nice assortment of beverages here to get us through what could be a rather lengthy podcast.
So I'm gonna go ahead and step out on a ledge here and say I believe the biggest film this weekend will be Star Wars.
You think?
They're saying they're wrapping up the true saga, the one that started in 1977 with Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, and Carrie Fisher. There have been spinoffs. There are now television programs. There have been animated shows. But they're saying this is the last one of the Skywalker clan, the one that you know and recognize for the past 42 years. And J.J. Abrams is back. He wrote and directed Episode 7, The Force Awakens, which was somewhat of a complete redoing of New Hope. Mm-hmm. Very similar arc. I would challenge that The Rise of Skywalker is more Return of the Jedi centric. A lot of people, and see, tell me if you agree with this. A lot of people are saying J.J. Abrams, who is back for Episode 9, made a sequel to Episode 7, and he pretended like Episode 8 does not exist.
Oh, I don't think so. I think Episode 8 was a means to an end, and this is the end. And so I think they worked as a trilogy. I liked watching all three. Was it a amazing Avengers Endgame type of conclusion for me? No, but it was a very satisfying conclusion to the 42-year-old Skywalker saga. But getting to that last 20 minutes, getting to that tie-up of loose ends and creating that sort of feeling of closure, it wasn't as good to me as I thought it could be. I think they tried to be everything to everyone, and the narrative got muddled in the process.
It is a nostalgia factory. Old characters reappear. Old lines, old locations, old themes.
Old creatures.
All pop up. And you're like, oh, you know what? I remember that from such and such episode. Unlike you, I do not think it works as a trilogy. 7 and 9 work together. They're the same film, pretty much. 8 is the outlier. J.J. Abrams is course correcting after the internet blew up and throttled Rian Johnson Some people love Episode 8. I am one of them. Some people loathe Episode 8 and said it ruined the franchise. How dare you make me think and challenge me with controversial themes in the land of Star Wars? I just want my nice... I want Ewoks. Don't give me the military-industrial complex. How dare you? And people questioning leadership authority. And a lot of people hated Episode 8, but maybe it shouldn't matter since how much it still made $1 billion.
Yeah, exactly.
But
so
these movies do not flow. J.J. Abrams rose out of the script Kelly Marie Tran, who was the lightning rod of controversy. The fanboys rioted with how this Asian female was the lead character of a Star Wars film. And she's barely in Episode 9.
I barely remember anything from Episode 8, which is, you know, so maybe it wasn't the best. But I remember enjoying it enough.
I think it was the best.
The thing is that I'm looking at it from a casual Star Wars fan perspective. I am not one of these, obsessed fans who know all the minutiae of every Star Wars iteration over time. I'm just watching it as, oh, wow, I remember Luke and Leia and Chewbacca and R2-D2 and C-3PO, and they're from my youth. And then I was really happy to see the trilogy that emerged in around 2015 and concludes with this one. That nostalgia trip for me is what it's all about. I'm not as worried about, just the little things. And I just think people just are reading they read way too much into it. And so for me, it was very satisfying, but it was not as satisfying as an Avengers Endgame kind of satisfying.
Well, this is a Rey film. This is a Daisy Ridley film. She's the main character, and the mystery is still there. It was set up in Episode 7. Who is Rey? Who are her parents? Where does she come from? And that mystery is really what drives the plot here, as people, they jump from location to location. I'm not going to get into it. You want to go into this fresh and spoiler-free, and we will make sure you do. One of the quirks that doesn't work for me is every Star Wars film introduces a couple new characters, and there are two main new characters this time around, both female. One of them spends the whole movie in a mask. In fact, it's Carrie Russell, who's a very recognizable face without a mask, but you wouldn't even know it's Carrie Russell because she never takes off the mask.
Yeah,
that got on my nerves.
It was weird because I actually was listening and I was like, that voice is so familiar. Who is that? So I wasn't sure while it was happening. And then to see Carrie Russell later in all the in the press tour and thing, go, oh, that's who that was. But I was. It took me out of the moment because her voice is very recognizable, very distinct. And so to not see her face was just a little odd.
And the film also has its version of Baby Yoda. It's his name is Babu Frick. And he's about to become... I think he's probably going to become a meme. He's going to become quite popular.
I suppose, between the Baby Yoda fan, craze that's going on. But I feel really sorry for like that little Baby Groot, because I think people are sort of forgetting all about Groot.
Baby Groot who? So Episode 9, I'm going to put right on the level of Episode 7. They're sequels to one another. They're back to back. Out of the whole trilogy, I'd still say Episode 8's probably my favorite, but it's not my favorite trilogy out of them all.
Well, it's my favorite trilogy out of them all because it's really the only trilogy that I've completed out of them all. But I love Adam Driver's having just an amazing year, and so him to see him as Kylo Ren again, when you've just seen him in Marriage Story and you've seen him in The Report, you're like, wow, he's just, just so good and watchable, the dynamic between Kylo and Rey returns in this film, and he's trying to pull her to the dark side. So I did appreciate it. It took me out of the moment a little bit to see all the footage that they had accumulated already using Carrie Fisher, even though she died in 2016.
Carrie Fisher.
It was
did
strange.
Not shoot one scene for this film,
and yet she's in this film.
Sorcery,
and it's not like it's CGI. It's like she is truly in this film. They had scenes that they had shot before, and I think that might have contributed to the narrative getting just a little off kilter for me, because I feel like maybe they backtracked, like they just had to figure out a way to work around the footage they had with her. So this isn't a perfect film. You know, it is satisfying, though, in that you feel like you get the closure that you needed. But without a doubt, I do not believe under any circumstances that this is the last that we have seen of Rey and Poe.
It's a good point. You know, why would Disney spend $4 billion just to conclude the franchise? They will make more movies, but they're saying it won't really be these characters. There'll be new stories, characters. And I think it's a shame. I think there's actually room to grow Rey.
There is. And so I think they will. But I see it as similar to how Avengers Endgame closed the loop on the Captain America Iron Man story. This closes the loop on the Luke and Leia story. And so, whereas we still get plenty of Avengers films, or those characters, many of those characters will reappear, I kind of felt that way with The Rise of Skywalker, that we've finished one story, but we've sort of set the table for another.
You know, it has nothing to do in this film? R2-D2.
He doesn't
feel bad
have,
for that guy. He's got nothing to do.
C-3PO has a couple of good lines and actually has a pretty good little subplot going.
Steals a couple scenes,
yeah,
in fact.
Yeah, he does. So
R2-D2
you're right.
Got nothing.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, R2.
All right, our next film. I did not see our next film, but man, if you think Star Wars is lighting up Twitter, check out for a moment what Cats is doing to the universe right now.
Wow.
Tell me, why is Cats ripping up a hole in the space-time continuum?
It is ripping a hole because no matter what, Cats, there are memories associated with Cats.
Is that a pun?
It is a pun, but it's also true. And with Cats, the musical stage production, which opened on Broadway in the early 80s and ran forever, Andrew Lloyd Webber, classic, classic show that a lot of people have always, always hated with a passion. So you have your people who love Cats, and you always had your people who just hated Cats. And then you had the ones who never saw any of it anyway. And really don't, you know, or just
raising my hand right now.
You're raising your hand because you're indifferent to the Cats, even though you own a cat. But, you know, so the film is causing this massive rift where you have people who absolutely hate it, people who love it. Dustin, I think, we saw one of our...
It was one of the best defenses I've ever
seen.
Dustin Putman.
Dustin somehow loved this film. And defends it to the death.
Great writing.
And then you've got, I sat next to Tim, our buddy Tim Gordon, who had never seen Cats and was like, sat there the whole movie going, what the hell? What the hell? It was hysterical for me.
It's a good impression.
Because he really had no clue what was going on. And you see these fur-painted actors that are this A-list cast painted in fur singing, and it's a very bizarre sight, and so it's really hard to get past that. And so the fact is, you've got a story.
Where are you falling on this movie? I have no idea what you think about
this
movie.
So what happens is, I love the music. I've always loved the music of Cats. I saw the original Broadway production. I know all the lyrics, so I knew the story. I could follow what was happening. But I could not get past these fur-painted actors of highest esteem.
Well, I heard the visual effects had a problem.
It's just weird. It's weird. And you're watching, and it's very hard to look past these cats. I mean, so whereas some people are like, you can get past the weirdness, I couldn't. The first hour also was a problem. It dragged. And so you did not bring the cat haters, or the people who were already prone to dislike this film, the first hour did them no favors. But on the positive side, and yes, I don't know where I come down on this movie other than that I'm not recommending it, but I loved certain production numbers within it. Taylor Swift wrote a new song called Beautiful Ghosts. Beautiful song. Really good. She co-wrote it with Andrew Lloyd Webber. It's an original song. It holds its own against the rest of the music. It did not make the list for the Oscars, which is, I think, fascinating because you're missing an opportunity to have Taylor Swift at the Oscars singing an original song.
Well, maybe it's not one of the five best.
No, I think a lot. I don't think enough Academy members saw it.
Oh, maybe.
To understand how it fits in, because I do think if people had really seen it, it would have made the cut. And Taylor Swift only sings it in the closing credits, one of the other characters.
Oh, so of course it works.
No, but one of the other... it works really well.
It's in the film, though.
It's in the film, sung by Francesca Hayward, who is really introduced in this film, playing this cat that kind of narrates some of what's going on. But she sings it, and she's a professional ballerina, ballet dancer. And this movie does have some really great... dancing. It's got some tap and some ballet. It's just that it's got things that you would just go back and watch on YouTube, like 3-minute segments.
Does the film look like it cost $100 million to make?
I don't know.
Because
I think it's ridiculous. I think it was doomed from the start. I just think the concept of trying to take this A-list cast and make them look like cats. I mean, you've got Judi Dench, Ian McKellen, Taylor Swift.
You texted me coming out of the movie about Idris Elba.
Idris Elba looked ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And when everyone was in the theater, just whenever he'd come on the screen, it was like, this isn't working. 2018 Sexiest Man Alive is not coming across in this brown cat suit. And so that to me was a problem. Individually, the performances, the singing, the dancing, you have James Corden and the usual scene stealer Rebel Wilson, who is not that great in this film, I didn't think. You know, she was sort of playing her usual sidekick shtick or supporting character shtick. This is a really tough one because as I think it was Dustin who predicts that it's going to become some sort of cult classic.
Things like this do.
And I can kind of see how that could happen. So while it might be denigrated and mocked to no end in the near future, it might be one of those ones that that kind of captures a new audience of kids maybe who like to listen to soundtracks over and over again and watch the clips on YouTube. And it is one that I can see being on an airplane and just sort of being one of those things that you can just put it on and tune out and just listen for the numbers that you like.
What kind of cult classic? Like, is it like cult classic like that people like We Got It Wrong? Or is it like a Rocky Horror where people throw stuff at the screen?
No, I think it's...
The Room.
The Room. It's
that kind of cult classic?
No, because it's still like well acted. It just doesn't work visually to me.
I did not.
Yeah. So, and I mean, there's really, it's hard because there's no real plot that anyone who doesn't already know the musical, they're not going to be able to understand what the heck is going on. You know, there's this Jellicle Ball, and once a year, one cat is chosen to go to the Heaviside Layer.
Are you really going to plot this?
But that's just it. There is this sort of story that if you don't already know it going in, you are just not going to grasp what's going on.
I'll take the cat's challenge when it comes out on DVD. How about that?
All right. I think you should have gone to see it because you challenged me to a certain film, and I really thought that it would have only been fair for you to have seen Cats because I did.
I didn't challenge you. The world challenged. Christian Hammaker challenged
you. I was challenged to see.
All right, fine. We'll skip what we were going to talk about. We'll dive right into this. You want to do this? We'll do this. Hannah, if you're a long-time listener to the podcast, Hannah has a hate-hate relationship with a particular director out there. She does not understand, does not see the vision of, cannot see through the lens of one Terrence Malick. And Terrence Malick, according to many critics, made the film of the decade.
He's an auteur.
He made The Tree of Life, and that it won a Palme d'Or. And plenty of critics say that's the number one film of the entire 2010s. Uh-huh. Hannah did not like that. she didn't like, I don't know if you even saw To the Wonder. You definitely didn't like. You hated Knight of Cups. I think that was your worst film of the year. You hated Song to Song.
Oh, terrible.
And so now he's back with what I would actually say, Hannah, is a linear film, a coherent film. It has dialogue in it, in fact. And it's, in a style that it's more than people just staring at clouds and talking about dirt. It's called A Hidden Life, and it's it, it has actual actors in it doing things. It takes place during World War II, specifically in Austria, about Franz Jägerstätter, a real man who lived. he was a peasant farmer in Austria. Looks like he had it looks like he was in paradise. The surrounding Alps are just gorgeous.
The hills are alive.
It's a Sound of Music. He was but he's poor, but he's happy. He's got a wife and three wonderful daughters, and then he gets called up to serve under Hitler. He's a conscientious objector. He's a pacifist. He doesn't want to kill anybody. His morals, his God, his religion say do not. His main problem is, though, his main sticking point is the loyalty oath. Everyone had to raise their right hand and swear loyalty to the Führer. And his moral compass, his code, would not allow him to do that. And you know what? In Nazi Germany, that's a way to stick out. That's a way people are going to learn your name. So I understand why this is Christian Hammacher's number one film of the year. And many Christian film critics' number one film of the year. It's a film about a crisis of conscience, a crisis of faith. This is probably my favorite Terrence Malick film ever, more than Badlands, more than Thin Red Line. Not only because I can understand it and I can talk legibly about it, as I really couldn't do with Knight of Cups. it's just gorgeous, and the score by James Newton Howard, who, by the way, has been nominated for an Oscar 8 times, yet to win, but gorgeous score, gorgeous cinematography. This is a really good movie, Hannah.
It is a Terrence Malick movie, though. I will give you this. It is my favorite Terrence Malick film.
That's not saying much.
You know? It's not, but it is my favorite because it is the closest to having a structured narrative of any of his films. But that's not saying much either, because what you have not pointed out is that here's your whole story. You have an Austrian farmer, crisis of conscience, becomes a conscientious objector, gets put on trial, is killed.
Whoa!
No,
spoilers.
That's not a spoiler.
How
it's
dare
based
you?
On a true story. The guy gets executed.
How
okay?
could I can't believe
so
you
takes,
just did that.
So you know what? It took three very long
Allow
hours
me to apologize
to tell this story.
To our listeners. Spoiler alert.
The folks that...
Well, nobody
like
knows
it,
this story.
I don't know. Somebody knows that he
it's
was...
It's not
then,
a famous story.
He was declared a martyr by the Catholic Church.
Nobody
Come on.
Knows this story.
That is the whole story. But oh. it, you can say the entire story...
So shocked at
in,
you.
The entire story in one line. Nobody would figure out what's going on over the course of 3 hours. I felt like I was watching this movie all day. It was like
on.
All day. I'm like, oh my God. Even you texted me and was like, oh, and you're only a third of the way through.
Yeah, it's a long movie.
It is an incredibly long movie, and it is still very much a Terrence Malick film in that it is a slog to watch.
No, it's not. It's
oh my. So
it is enjoyable.
The score is beautiful.
Yes.
The scenery when he's
this.
Not being tortured is
were
beautiful.
Were you watching the movie or were you doing things, Hannah? I know what you do when you watch movies.
I was trying
were
to watch it.
Were you doing your Christmas cards,
I
Hannah?
I was trying to watch it. But this is still, no matter how you slice it, this is one of those ambitious films that will appeal to Terrence Malick devotees.
This is not a standard Malick film.
It's not standard, but it's still Malick. And and it's pretentious. And it's still big on sounds.
It's the best edited film of the year.
Snippets of best edited.
Yes.
It's like
it took them 3 years to edit it. You know, two of those actors
are
dead.
I'm not surprised. Well, you know, one of the actors had actually said, and I jotted this down, about how Terrence Malick likes to he creates spaces rather than produces scenes.
What's wrong
well,
with that?
I prefer a movie that takes scenes and creates spaces within scenes.
Well, what's harder to follow, A Hidden Life or Cats?
A Hidden Life is it's the same premise where you kind of need to know what the log line is for both of those films in order to understand it. And if you don't know the log lines going in, you are not necessarily going to be able to track it.
A Hidden Life is not obtuse. It's not a hard film.
It's not that it's hard.
Of course you're
going to
know what
it's
about
slow.
If you just sit there and watch it.
But for 3 hours.
Oh, Hannah.
For three very slow hours.
You're going to come out on the minority on this one.
I, not among any, who's going to see, more people are going to see Cats than are going to see A Hidden Life.
Are they though?
I'm going to bet you.
No, I won't take the bet.
You want a wine wager?
Cats is on 3,300 screens.
There's a reason. There's a reason that nobody's going to sit in a theater for 3 hours to watch A Hidden Life. I watched enough people walk out of Knight of Cups over the course of 2 hours that I can't even imagine people sitting in there for three. Is there relevant,
no
timely, important themes in this film?
Yes.
Absolutely. Is it about sacrifice and standing up to evil? Am I grateful that this guy existed and that he did the right thing? Absolutely. But it took 3 hours to tell me the same story that I saw in The Sound of Music just last weekend.
Well, those are different stories.
The same general themes, I believe, are the same. And the same general themes, I believe, are the same in Jojo Rabbit, which I think is a much more accessible, it's satire, but it's a much more accessible film.
The only thing Jojo Rabbit and Hidden Life have in common is the time they take place in.
I don't think so, because it's still about standing up and following your conscience and not blindly agreeing with somebody who has absolutely no moral compass whatsoever. So I think there are very relevant themes that are similar in both of those films and in The Sound of Music. And so would I rather watch Captain Von Trapp and Maria singing and traipsing across the mountains and still battling the Nazis? Absolutely. I will watch Sound of Music 100 times over before I will be able to really think about ever seeing A Hidden Life again.
A Hidden Life is just as good looking as The Sound of Music.
But nothing, it's slow
it's
as
not,
molasses.
It is not slow. It's cerebral, yes.
Cerebral.
We're talking about a man discussing the consequences of it. Just sign your name. Just sign your name. Your family needs you.
But it's preachy.
It's a fast 3 hours.
Oh my God, it is not a fast 3 hours. And it says the same thing over and over and over again for 3 hours. It's thought-provoking, but it's slow, and it takes 3 hours to get to the same point that so many other films get to a lot faster. It's just things like over and over, better to suffer injustice than to do it. And, you know, the guy's told, sign the loyalty oath and you'll go free. But as a conscientious objector, he says, I am free. And those kinds of lines hit you over the head.
You're mocking this.
I'm not mocking it. I'm just saying that it hits you over the head with the same thing for 3 hours. And I just felt that it's a film that creates spaces and does not produce scenes. And I just know that if you're the type of movie viewer that prefers to see a more conventional narrative, while this is the most conventional narrative that you'll ever get from a Terrence Malick film.
Since Badlands.
Yeah. It's still not going to, it's not going to be most people's cup of tea. It's going to be critically acclaimed for all the reasons that you mentioned, but that doesn't make it watchable for the masses at all.
A Hidden Life is one of the better films of this year, hands down.
It's going to be like Cats. I think it will be very divisive.
A Hidden Life will not be a cult classic. It's not an airplane watch.
The claws are out.
Speaking of claws.
It would have to be a very long flight in order for you to watch.
it had to be bi-coastal.
It would have to be to Japan or something. You'd have to really be going far.
New York to LA, you'd fit in just fine. Wow.
If you needed.
I love when you get all spun up like this.
Terrence Malick does that to me.
He really does that, doesn't he? A Hidden Life is like Your Sweet Home Alabama. All right, our next wide release this weekend is Bombshell, and it's definitely an ensemble piece. Bombshell is recent. You probably remember it from the news from 2015, 2016, when Fox News, specifically Roger Ailes, fell apart, starting with Gretchen Carlson, who was kind of fading at the station. She sued Roger Ailes for years of sexual harassment and retaliation. She's not the only Fox News personality featured in Bombshell. The one who's making all the news and all the waves and getting all the nominations is Charlize Theron as Megyn Kelly. Talk about sore. You think Carrie Fisher in Star Wars, A Sorcery. Look at Charlize Theron as Megyn Kelly. That is some straight up sorcery.
It is crazy. It is so spot on. It's eerie to watch.
She's Bombshell's main protagonist, the lead actress. And she's somewhat also like A Hidden Life in a moral dilemma. Do I advance my career or do I do what is right or maybe what I should have done 10 years ago? The investigation's going on. Will other women speak up and join Gretchen Carlson and say there's a pattern of sexual harassment here at Fox News? Or will they be loyal and heed their loyalty oaths that they took?
I think Franz Jagerstatter's sacrifice is probably a little more substantial than Megyn Kelly.
I'm with you. And the third female to round out the main ensemble is Margot Robbie as the composite character. Yeah. She's the newbie, the fresh fish who makes it a point to sneak in surreptitiously into Rogers' office and say, I am your next anchor. And he, played by very well, by the way, by John Lithgow, makes her prove it. He said, find a way to prove your loyalty to me.
Show me your legs.
Bombshell, you think it's, when you see the preview, you think it's going to be divisive. Oh, right, red staters will never go see it. Well, it's not really about a right-left divide. Mm-hmm. It's about a toxic atmosphere at a specific workplace and how it was allowed to fester for so long. And it's a very punchy script. It's written by the guy who did The Big Short, so he knows how to write. But it's a curious director choice in Jay Roach, the man who did three Austin Powers films. Meet the Fockers, is taking on somewhat of a weighty subject. It's not a full-up drama. There's some biting comedic satire in it, and it's set well with me. What I'm trying to say is I really enjoyed Bombshell. Not one of my favorites of the year, but definitely Charlize Theron and the script make me take notice.
Yeah, it's the first real Me Too feature, I think, that since the movement began. Timing-wise, it was very interesting. It's like I didn't really realize until later that really the whole thing with the downfall of Roger Ailes, that preceded really even any of the revelations relating to Harvey Weinstein. And so it really was like that first big trigger that snowballed. And so I find it a little strange that Gretchen Carlson and Megyn Kelly both deny having any involvement in this film, because it just seems everyone has non-disclosure agreements. And so that played a part in whether they could actually say that anybody contributed a certain amount to the script. But I'm not sure I really buy that they didn't kind of know what their characters were going to come off like in this film. It's certainly dramatized, and I agree that the main reason to see this film is it's just fascinating to see somebody like Charlize Theron absolutely become somebody else that's still around. And it's not, you're right, it's not a red state, blue state divide film that that you might think. It is definitely more of a film about the Me Too movement and what it takes, that there's strength in numbers and really just sort of stepping up when you have to. My biggest issue, though, is that I never really liked Megyn Carlson. I never really liked Megyn Kelly or Gretchen Carlson or Fox News at all. And I felt a little manipulated into sort of feeling some sympathy where there's more to it. I mean, these women really rose through the ranks and made a lot of money peddling a lot of false narratives for Fox. And so I just think we're, no pun intended, skirting over a lot of the issues relating to these personalities in order to make the bigger point about Roger Ailes and his abuse of power.
Well, there's some buffoonishness going on. Richard Kind plays Rudy Giuliani, and it's a caricature. It's actually a cartoon. It's hard to watch. It's terrible. Someone's going to play Rudy Giuliani one day in the real movie, and this is going to come out looking really bad.
I didn't care because there's a slew of people. They had lookalikes Bill O'Reilly.
The Geraldo one.
Geraldo
was
definitely a really...
And I don't watch Fox News, so I don't know how...
But you can watch Saturday Night Live.
like a lot of actually a lot of them were look like Kate McKinnon's in it. So yes. that callback is there.
Yeah.
And I don't know what Jeanine Pirro looks like in real life on the show, but it seems like
it seems real, you know. And from the SNL sketches, it feels like that they're on target with that. Greta Van Susteren, really, the Bill O'Reilly lookalike is also just spot on. He's not as
well. They had the real Bill O'Reilly there too.
Part of it in some clips, yeah. But there's a scene where you're just like, "Wow, that looks just like him." So it's but you've got an amazing cast. Allison Janney is in there. Malcolm McDowell. It's like, oh my god!
You do,
every 2 seconds, somebody else comes on board. You know, you see someone else in this film. And you're like, wow.
I like what you're saying about Megyn Kelly. She's a very sympathetic character in this film. And then you have to remember in real life her getting in trouble over Santa Claus will always mm-hmm. be white. How can you ever have a black Santa Claus? And blackface is okay. And things like which got her fired from like NBC. So it's a very sympathetic character,
right.
But in context, she's not that sympathetic in real life.
No, and I did not, I didn't think she'd ever survive on NBC. I didn't like the fact that she got that show on, she got an hour on NBC after Fox. And therein lies part of the problem with this is that with the people that took the high profile people to step up to protect the lower level people that were kind of stuck in this toxic environment. Yes, it paints them in a light that I think is exaggerated to the point of making them more likable than they really are. The fact that Margot Robbie's character is not a real person. And so she's got the weightiest, I guess, sort of scene.
She's got the most drama.
She's got the most drama, but that's because she's not a real person. That character is this composite of like 20 Fox staffers. The Kate McKinnon character is actually, to me, one of the most recognizable from having been in newsrooms for me. Because here's somebody, she plays a Fox producer who is a closet lesbian and a closet Democrat and Hillary supporter. And she's questioned as to why in the world is she working at Fox? And the answer is one that I know is familiar among many people who I know who went to Fox. And that is they got the job and they got more money. And they were essentially going to be doing the same work at Fox that they might have been doing at another network. Where they couldn't either get into the network or they didn't get the promotions that then they were able to get at Fox. And so from an industry perspective, I understood where her character was coming from, that yes, you kind of had to swallow a lot of disagreement with the agenda of the network, but there were moments and there are certain programs and certain personalities that aren't as egregious to be working for. And so you can't paint all staffers with the same brush. And I think that that kind of came across a little bit in a positive way in this film.
Yeah, surprisingly, I didn't want to watch it just because I really don't like Fox News. But surprisingly, it's a very effective film. I'm glad I saw it.
I'm glad I saw it. It's good. Is it in my top 10? No. But I think it can wait and be streamed later. I don't think people need to rush out at Christmas time to go see this particular film.
All right, we're going to talk very quickly about the films that are opening on Christmas Day because we're not going to do a full episode next week. We're going to take next week off because we're going to return with our infamous and very, if you thought A Hidden Life was contentious, with our amazing top 10 lists. And before we even launch into that, I just want to remind everybody that The Two Popes is now on Netflix as of today. Wonderful film, by the way, The Two Popes.
Oh, and we should quickly mention one other film that is actually going to be on ESPN.
Well, if you remember, a couple years ago at AFI Docs, we saw a 30 for 30, an ESPN 30 for 30. It was called Year of the Scab. It was the closing night film of the festival. It was wonderful. They had former Scab Redskin players from 1987. It was wonderful. So now we're going to try our hands again at a 30 for 30. And this one's a peculiar topic in sports, but a very important one about tennis. And it's not about, we've talked about John McEnroe before in a couple of films and his notoriety. This one has Serena Williams in it getting upset. And she's getting upset because judges are not infallible. Their eyeballs are slower than the tennis ball moves. Is the tennis ball in? Is the tennis ball out? This is a 30 for 30 about Hawkeye. Did the technology, Hawkeye, where the ball is, where the ball isn't, work for you?
Well, the film, it's called Subject to Review, and it really is only like 30, 35 minutes long. But I joked, I threw us off with our order earlier because we weren't supposed to get till Terrence Malick until the end. And then I thought there'd be the perfect segue into this particular short documentary, because I really was left wondering if the director perhaps went to the Terrence Malick School of Short Documentary Filmmaking, because this is not your standard type of documentary. There's not much tennis in it. And it really is more about the technology and camera placement and margin of error. You mentioned a little bit with Serena. There was, it took about 24 minutes in to finally see a close call in a Nadal-Federer match. And I'm like, yay, finally some tennis. But it really was to just demonstrate how the margin of error in a really close call can
millimeters.
Impact a match.
Millimeters.
And that judges are not infallible. And actually, in some ways, the machines are not totally infallible either, because there is that margin of error and things can happen within a millimeter of a second. And it's a tennis movie for technical geeks.
I noticed the music I felt would be more comfortable in a space documentary. It's very
ethereal.
And
the narration. That not only is the music ethereal, but the narration is ethereal.
And they show the narrator.
They show the voiceover guy. And I mean, this almost lulled me to sleep, because he has this very lilting. I felt like I was watching some Nat Geo documentary about the Wild Kingdom. And it was not at all what I expected.
I'm not like, this is an odd.
It's an odd
ESPN production.
It does not feel like a standard 30 on 30.
Please remind us again when it's on.
It's going to be on. It premieres, I think, Sunday, December 22nd at 3:00 Eastern on ESPN. And you know how it usually works with these, that they then kind of pop up again and again, or people will be able to find it on demand. It's a pretty hefty treatment of a sports technology story.
It takes it seriously.
It takes itself very seriously. I was joking that, not even joking, but it quotes the Talmud, you know, like rabbinical commentary, like, you know, according to a third century rabbi, you know, and it was like, oh my God, it has this quote that I'm not sure is
John McEnroe was really tearing up people back then.
Yeah. So I was like, oh my goodness, I'm not really sure that that's what the rabbis had in mind when they made this quote, but very deep, man. This was just like one of those like sports documentaries that you're like, wow, that's pretty deep.
it is one of the more serious and cerebral ESPN documentaries you will run into.
Yeah, so you know, if you do happen to catch it, let us know what you think, because it's an interesting one.
All right, so opening on when, it doesn't always open on Friday, because Christmas is a time when people get tired of family and they go to the movies. So that's why there's also a slew of movies that will open on Wednesday, Christmas Day. Probably what I think is the biggest one is 1917. I don't want to talk a lot about it, because hint, hint, it's going to pop up on our 10 best of the year episode. Just know, directed by Sam Mendes, the camera is just as much of a character as either of the two leads are. It's a World War I film. It's visceral. It's loud. It's shaky. It's amazing. 1917 is the movie to see on Christmas.
It's the movie to see on the big screen. There's absolutely no way where you can take a film like this and say, I'll just wait and catch it later on the small screen. It needs to be seen on the biggest screen you can find. And you will be immersed. And so it's absolutely, we will talk about it, I'm sure, more in our top films of 2019. But in the meantime, keep 1917 on your radar for, you know, it's a war movie. And so depending on what you're going for over the Christmas holiday and how your group is being split up and how your family is being divided, people are going to go in, I suspect people are going to go into different theaters. And the theater that most of the women are going to go into will be to go see Little Women.
I was thinking about the girls, the women in Little Women Theater will still be able to hear the 1917 theater next door.
It will be booming.
You ever hear the boom, ba 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 boom, boom, you know, and you're watching Florence Pugh and you're watching Saoirse Ronan and you're going to hear this boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, Greta Gerwig, who wrote and directed this adaptation of the Louisa May Alcott classic, will, I'm sure, not be terribly happy if her strategic choices for her Little Women film get bombarded by the sounds of external or of Star Wars playing in other theaters around her. But Little Women, I think, will be the film of choice for a lot of female gatherings for groups of women and mothers and daughters. And it is, as adaptations go, for a movie that we feel like we've seen many times before.
Not even felt like we've seen Little Women
that
many
we have
times.
And have read and know these characters. Just know that this is a really good ensemble film. And in addition to just having Greta Gerwig as the writer-director, she just loves her usual suspects. You know, she Saoirse Ronan as Jo March, and Florence Pugh is very good, plays a somewhat different Amy than we've seen in other iterations. Emma Watson, I think, is good, you know, not as memorable in this film. But then Timothée Chalamet is probably my favorite surprise. Not even surprise. I've always loved Timothée Chalamet. I think he's great.
You do.
And he just proves once again that he plays the neighbor Laurie and is really just a great character, and he pulls it off. And so Little Women will be a really good choice, I think, for over the Christmas holiday.
It's a different Florence Pugh character. We saw her in three different films this year. It's different than her character in Midsommar, for
which
certainly.
I still have to catch up on.
And Fighting With My Family was the other one she popped up in.
Yeah, and so she's got some versatility.
Can you compare that? I recall vividly the 1994 version with Susan Sarandon and Winona Ryder. Do you have one better than the other?
I somehow like this movie. I like this version better. But I think what it all just goes to show is that there's just aspects of this story that are timeless.
Well, there's the 1933 version and the 1949
but
version.
But each time you still feel that there are things that that just feel contemporary in their own way. And there are some themes that are contemporary themes about female empowerment and sisterhood. And I think a lot of people, there's one problem I would say is that there is a time shift that goes on within Little Women where it goes back and forth in time to their younger characters, still played by the same actors. And then like 7 years later, and sometimes you really get lost. You're not clear on which time frame you're in. And so that device didn't really work all that well. But aside from that, the film overall is just a really solid, good adaptation.
Well, the other film opening on Christmas Day is actually the most intense film of the year. 1917 is not the most intense film of the year. It's actually starring Adam Sandler. It takes place in New York City, and it's called Uncut Gems. And when I say Adam Sandler, I mean, this is like watching if a line of cocaine got up off the mirror and started acting. That is what this movie is like. It is, I had to get up and I had to pace the theater afterward. I was so wound up and spun when Uncut Gems ended. I was shook. I've really never seen anything like it. I love the directors, the Safdie brothers, because their Good Time a couple years ago, starring Robert Pattinson, was one of my 10 best films of the year. I loved it so much. And this one looks very similar. It's shot very similar to Good Time. Adam Sandler is a Diamond District dealer I think he's mentally ill. If you know basketball, this is right up your alley, because the Kevin Garnett actually has a sizable role in this film. Gambling problems, always trying to catch the best deal. Adam Sandler is getting notice. He's getting nominations because Daniel Day-Lewis called Adam Sandler after he saw this film and said, And he asked him questions. How did you do this? And when Daniel Day-Lewis is calling you to ask how you did this, that says something.
It does. I mean, I did watch this film. It's not, I was not a huge fan of Good Time, but I still appreciated the look and feel of that film. This is very similar. This is worth seeing strictly to just sort of be like really kind of awed by Adam Sandler's performance. But it's a very gritty movie. And so I don't think it's going to do very well opening Christmas Day. It's just not, it's not a Christmas movie.
Well, it's counter-programming.
It's counter-programming, but I don't think it'll work. I think there's too much else that, to me, this isn't, unlike 1917 and Little Women that have like, the production just really needs to be seen and deserves to be seen on the big screen. Uncut Gems is one that I think can wait.
Actually, I think it's actually for the Jewish audience that goes to movies on Christmas.
No, I don't know anybody who'd go see that over Little Women or 1917 or Cats or Star Wars or even Bombshell. So I'm just, I think you have to really be in the right frame of mind.
There is no right frame of mind.
There is no right frame of mind for Uncut Gems, which is why I think you kind of need to wait and stream it.
It's unsettling.
It's unsettling. And so who wants, there's enough unsettling stuff, and who needs that at the holidays? So I would say that Uncut Gems can wait, but it's worth putting in the queue.
All right. Well, instead of doing just a long wrap-up, you can just rewind and figure out if you missed something. But I just once again want to apologize on behalf of Hannah for spoiling A Hidden Life. It's egregious.
I am so sorry for the two of you and Christian that may that may be planning to watch another, you know, Terrence Malick film. But so we're off next week. Next podcast will feature our highly anticipated countdown of our favorite films of 2019, which I can already guarantee you will need to open at least two more bottles of wine to get through that one.
I don't know how many Avengers films I made this year because you always put every single one on your list, so we'll see how many pop up.
Spoiler alert!
I just have a hunch. All right, well, thank you for listening to this Christmas time episode of the Cinema Clash.
Not quite as bloated as a Terrence Malick movie, but still kind of long.
You're going to have to move past this, Hannah. Hannah, you're going to have to let this go.
All right.
I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.